Freedom, transparency, honesty, meritocracy, fairness, voluntarism, and hard work are great things one should strive toward, whether it is in developing money or living life and setting a good example for others. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. This is Bitcoin Audible, where you will learn everything and anything there is to know about Bitcoin. And I am your professor, Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anyone else you know. The proof of work on that tagline has gotten out of control. I am trying to actually figure out how many hours I have actually recorded in audio on Bitcoin, which is really only a fraction of what I've read. So I'm going to see if I can get a legit number soon. Lots of other work to finish first, but I'm very intrigued. You know, they say mastery is 10,000 hours. I can't help but wonder. I don't know. We'll see. Anyway, we have a great piece from Hass McCook today. We've had a piece of his on the show, I think once or twice, maybe, at this point. But the piece actually kind of sounded mundane when I heard it on Bitcoin Magazine. When I saw the title, it was about a PPE curriculum and how Bitcoin was, you know, you had to have Bitcoin in. And I was like, people curriculum, what the hell are you talking about? Nah, I decided to stop and read it. I was like, no, this piece is fire. So it is about the broad and kind of foundational aspects of Bitcoin and its philosophy, the politics, the ethics, its governance, and the economics that the system embodies, and how no understanding of social phenomena can be complete without a deep study of Bitcoin. It is a great piece, but before we jump in real fast, let's hit our lovely sponsors for the show. You know them, you love them, I love them. They are everything you need in Bitcoin in one place, starting with the Swan Bitcoin Savings Plan. This is literally just where you buy Bitcoin, guys. Like, exchanges suck. Do not get trapped in an exchange. Just go to swanbitcoin.com/guy. Cheap, easy, automatic, no-brainer. Then I am stacking all the time with the Fold card. This is a debit rewards card. I mean, they've got gift cards and all sorts of other great stuff that you can get discounts with, but I basically moved all of my finances to the Fold card. I get sats back on my bills. 20% off the premium card at guyswan.com/fold. Code is right on that page. You'll see it. Then all of the sats that you stack with Swan and Fold, you gotta keep them safe. Get a BitBox hardware wallet. Please don't leave them on an exchange if you have significant savings. The BitBox O2 is easy to use, easy to set up. It's super secure, open source, all the great stuff. It's a wonderful cold storage device for your Bitcoin. 5% off with code GUY, G-U-Y. Seriously, three letters. If you forget that, it's your fault. And then lastly, get your tickets to Bitcoin 2022. And don't forget the discount, Guy Swan. Add my name to the my last name to that one, S-W-A-N-N, 10% off for your Bitcoin 2022 tickets. This is the Bitcoin conference, and I keep hearing about people who paid full price. What is wrong with you? 10% off, G-U-I-S-W-A-N-N. That is all it takes. Type it. Okay, with that, let's get into today's article with a rather obnoxious guy's take to follow. And this one is by Hass McCook, and it is titled, Why You Can't Have a PPE Curriculum Without Bitcoin, by Hass McCook. Bitcoin is clearly a social phenomenon worthy of study for a proper philosophy, politics, and economics, or PPE, degree. In 1920, the toffs at the University of Oxford decided that those students with ambitions of entering public service needed a better degree to equip them for a modern, post-war world. They reasoned that in order to understand social phenomena and govern effectively, you must have a firm grasp of philosophy, ethics and reasoning, politics and its history, and finally, economics. The degree, known as Philosophy, Politics, and Economics, or PPE, would be born, and first delivered at Oxford in 1921, with no less than an Oscar winner, a princess, two Nobel laureates, three British prime members, 12 non-UK prime ministers, representing Australia, Pakistan, Peru, and Thailand, three foreign presidents, representing Ghana, Peru, and Pakistan, and hundreds of other highly senior members of public service, all graduating. This excludes all the alumni from the hundreds of world-leading universities that now also provide a PPE degree. Whether or not the degree has fulfilled the ambitions of its creators could be debated, but the logic of the program is sound. In order to understand complicated social phenomena, your knowledge needs to be deep and broad. In the 1920s, philosophy, politics, and economics were probably enough to do the trick. But in October 2021, 13 years after the release of the Bitcoin white paper, understanding of exponential technologies and how they're built and adopted is now a critical fourth pillar. But before we get into the PPE of the exponential technology that is Bitcoin, let's quickly define what social phenomena are and whether Bitcoin classifies as one. What are social phenomena? The term social phenomena can be broadly defined as events, trends, or reactions that take place within an established human society evidenced through collective modifications of behavior, which could effectively mean anything. Examples of social phenomena include market and consumer trends, popular political movements or rebellions, social trends like crime or poverty, and religious movements. Indeed, the most successful popular movements in history came about because they offer adherents a full PPE stack for life. For example, Western democracy is underpinned by a completely different philosophical, political, and economic model than, say, communism. Indeed, your economics are virtually inseparable from your politics and philosophy. Based on the definition and aforementioned examples, it would be fair to call the invention of Bitcoin an event that affected, quote, collective modifications of behavior, that has rebellious underpinnings and is frequently called a religion, whether as a proud admission or as a sharp criticism. Now that we've determined that Bitcoin is a social phenomenon, let's have a look at the PPE stack that Bitcoin offers its adherents. Bitcoin philosophy. There is no shortage of Bitcoin philosophers, and you could spend hundreds of hours reading about and listening to the different schools of philosophical thought. Despite this, there are certain philosophical elements that are universal, and many are alluded to in Bitcoin's founding document. These are: Bitcoin is voluntary, and voluntary approaches are always superior to mandatory ones. Bitcoin is open, and maximum transparency allows for a maximum number of eyes looking at the code and sharing ideas. How does any individual entity possibly compete with this? Bitcoin is fair. It cannot be created out of thin air or forcefully seized or redistributed. You must expend work in order to acquire Bitcoin. Decentralization is always preferable to centralization when it comes to money and many other things. Everyone has the right to send and receive value without a third party, no exceptions, even for people we dislike. Either everyone is free to transact or no one is. A deflationary fixed supply asset is the superior money. And a peer-to-peer network that timestamps transactions by hashing them into an ongoing chain, validated by hash-based proof-of-work, is the best way to achieve this. Everybody in the world should be able to easily keep a copy of Bitcoin at home, so that everyone has the opportunity to be a truly sovereign Bitcoin citizen. If you do not voluntarily hand over custody of your private keys, your Bitcoin cannot be taken away from you ever. It is almost impossible not to get a religious tingle down your spine when you realize the implications of the impossibility of seizure. Bitcoin politics, governance. A cynic would say that politics are the activities of acquiring and maintaining power, and governance is what is done by those in power. To that end, there isn't really any political process in Bitcoin, just decentralized voluntary contributions that succeed on their technical merits. That said, the governance model of Bitcoin is very clearly defined, with Bitcoin Magazine's very own Aaron Von Wertheim writing about it extensively in 2016, and veteran industry analyst Pierre Richard adding additional details in 2018. I would strongly recommend reading both for a thorough education on the topic. There is also a surprisingly thorough and unbiased account found in research published by the Stanford Journal of Blockchain Law and Policy earlier in 2021. I summarize the above works below. The political players in Bitcoin. In terms of who has actual political power when it comes to Bitcoin's governance, it is the users and miners. All miners are users, but not all users are miners. Although user can be a broad term, in this context it means somebody who runs and uses a Bitcoin software implementation on their computer, i.e., runs a node. When it comes to Bitcoin governance, simply holding Bitcoin does not make you a user or give you any influence. The miners are tasked with producing blocks in line with the rules of the Bitcoin protocol, and over 90% of miners need to support any proposed protocol changes before they can be implemented. Software governance versus protocol governance. In the previous section, I referred to users as those who have downloaded and run a particular Bitcoin software implementation. The main or reference implementation is Bitcoin Core. However, other implementations like LeBitcoin also exist. An implementation is simply a way to communicate with and follow the Bitcoin protocol. And if you have the skills, you can build and use your own implementation. For everyone else, there's Bitcoin Core or an equivalent. Regardless of how the various software implementation teams decide to govern themselves, if users aren't willing to download their software, they will have no impact on Bitcoin. Bitcoin is whatever the consensus of the users say it is. Talk about the customer always being right. Protocol governance process. Richard outlines the 5-step Bitcoin change and governance process as follows. 1. Research or problem identification. Every solution starts with a problem. Solving these problems typically requires lots of research. Since it's an open, voluntary platform, users are left to scratch their own itch when it comes to solving problems. 2. Proposal. When a user has found a solution to a problem, they present this to the world through the Bitcoin improvement process, starting with the creation of a Bitcoin Improvement Proposal, or BIP, and going through the long, technocratic, and meritocratic process of critique and development, which can sometimes last many years, until the solution is ready for implementation in one of the various Bitcoin implementations. Not all BIPs see the light of implementation. 3. Implementation. Depending on how robust the development peer review process was and whether the proposal is contentious or not, implementation can be quick or slow. In the case of a highly contentious proposal, Bitcoin Core developers, for example, would not implement a proposal without a supermajority of 90% or more of miners signaling support. The small minority still in disagreement are free to copy-paste Bitcoin's code and create their own version based on their rule set. 4. Deployment. After the Bitcoin implementation software developers are convinced, it's now time to convince the users to download and use this new implementation. At this point, however, non-technical users can generally rely on the intense scrutiny of the process by miners, community members, and developers, with technical users having the benefit of reviewing and understanding the public review process themselves if they so choose. 5. Enforcement. This is the easiest bit of all, literally using software to check some math. All of the rules necessary to check this math lives on the tens of thousands of Bitcoin nodes around the world, and they will simply refuse and ban peers that aren't complying with the latest consensus rule set. Bitcoin economics. While an entire library can be written about Bitcoin economics, the executive summary is Bitcoin's supply formula below. And here we have the formula for Bitcoin supply, which roughly equals 21 million. Bitcoin offers users the following economic guarantees. 1. Fixed supply enforced by code. 2. Highly inelastic, diminishing, predefined issuance regulated by the difficulty adjustment. And 3. Property rights. Bitcoin frees users from the following economic burdens. 1. Government and central bank incompetence and malfeasance. 2. Seigniorage, inflation, and hyperinflation. 3. Unfair taxation and regulation. 4. Counterparty risk. It is out of this economic simplicity that the hardest money ever known to man has emerged. The Bitcoin PPE full stack. It isn't just the robust technical and economic underpinnings that make Bitcoin revered by so many, but also the philosophical and political full stack that provides Bitcoiners what is effectively a blueprint for life. Freedom, transparency, honesty, meritocracy, fairness, voluntarism, and hard work are great things one should strive toward, whether it is in developing money or living life and setting a good example for others. The greatest and most enduring movements in history, be they political, social, or religious, have been accompanied by a full PPE stack. And with a full stack as powerful as Bitcoin's, it is on track to being the greatest movement the world has ever or will ever see. There is no doubt that teaching of Bitcoin philosophy, politics, and economics should be included in any serious PPE programs that claim to be producing our next generation of leaders. All right, and that closes out this amazing piece by Hass McCook. Let's take a quick break for our sponsor, and we will be right back. And that is Swan Bitcoin. No relation, by the way. People keep asking me still if I made Swan Bitcoin. I cannot take credit for that. Their Swan is spelled with one N, mine is spelled with two. But you know what I do have with Swan? The simplest damn savings plan that exists. It is a straight no-brainer. They are a place to buy Bitcoin. That's it, baby. Buy and learn about Bitcoin. They got low fees. It is simple to use. It is easy to set up. Automatic purchases. I got mine running every week. And automatic withdrawals, which I have mine set for like a few million sats. Done. That's it. I buy every week. I bought this week. I bought last week. All the others, I never stop. Swan does it automatically and withdraws to my cold storage multi-sig wallet. Like, what? Nobody else does that. It's annoying and expensive to get your coins off some exchanges and services. Swan does it for free and without you having to touch it. There's just nothing better. Sign up now and you will actually get to see my beautiful face at the top of swanbitcoin.com/guy. And I got a really cool quote up there that I'm super proud of. So if you want to read it, go over there, swanbitcoin.com/guy. Get your automatic savings account and buy Bitcoin the smart way. All right, so I want to talk about this piece a little bit. Hass McCook has, I think he's got a couple of pieces now that we've read on the show. Always great one, definitely a great one to follow. I'll have the link in the show notes so you can follow Hass online, on Twitter. But it's really funny. I never quite think a lot about Bitcoin in the academics scene. A couple of pieces, like Bradley Rettler is a professor of philosophy, and he's written a couple of different pieces, and he talks a lot about, like, from that mindset, and he's very, like, kind of in the academia framework, I guess you could say. And it's really interesting because I guess I've been so out of it for such a long time now that I just don't think about education. And maybe it's my bias is that I just kind of think the entire thing is such a bloated shithole. Because no offense to of those who are in academia, but just that the quality of the product against the price is very much the same story that's happened with housing, with healthcare, with so much in the economy, and academia has been really a profound victim of it. And if you see, it's very much the same story as you see in healthcare, is that the growth in administrators has been like, you know, hundreds and even thousands of percent increases over like 30 years. But then the number of doctors have just been flat. And you see a lot of that same stuff in education, just administrators and bureaucracy and all of this crap, and huge amounts of new development and movements in academia that are just there to get dumber, like more dumbed down and more students, because they're just fishing for more debt. The quality of the product has been severely, severely hit. And particularly when you're talking about the cost of getting that education. I say even with the more and more I dig into it, even with like highly technical things where the industries and the job market wants that certification, it still seems to make a shit ton of sense to avoid. When you're talking like dollar to dollar, if you were talking about actually paying for it, it makes no sense. The only reason in any of it makes sense is because the government is essentially giving you a free loan or a dirt cheap loan for an extended amount of time. But anyway, that's not even what I was trying to get into. The PPE, the idea of a PPE program, and that there's a quote I saved from the beginning of this that says, they reasoned that in order to understand social phenomena and govern effectively, you must have a firm grasp of philosophy, ethics and reasoning, politics and its history, and finally, economics. And, you know, you could argue that this is kind of the foundation, maybe, or the idea, the principle of trying to create someone or create a discipline that has a very broad view of a lot of things. Because I think that's something that's very missing. And I think it's actually something that's missing a lot in academia, is the need to separate, to segregate different categories, different disciplines, and regiment them, make them very, very isolated from one another. Like, I can't remember who told me this exactly, but there was someone who... It was a biology versus history. I think those were the two topics or whatever. But somebody in, I think there was like a biology professor, had some sort of profound thing that they had discovered or dug into about history. And essentially it was when they proposed it, I guess you could say, or made it public within their university environment, they got trashed. Like, the history professors were like, you stay in your own effing lane, dude. Like, you're not over here. We do the history stuff. And I think the illusion, the evolution of academia as this authority, as this idea of like, we are the people who do this, and that people spend their whole lives in academia without actually having done the thing, without actually having gone out and been part of the world in that, you know, like an example would be many of my film professors were teaching film and had never done film. They went straight from film school to film teaching. And not that they were bad at it, but that there's a big difference between somebody who's incredibly skilled in something and has done something for a long time going in and teaching somebody the practical, the very like gritty on the ground, this is what the world is like around this skill set. And that person is going to have a much broader knowledge. It's not going to be isolated about just film. It will all be related to film. They can teach all of these life lessons and these things around it in how they interact or relate to this discipline, but they're going to have a much broader scope of what's important. And this idea of a PPE, of this full stack of stuff, is kind of the concept of creating a Renaissance man, or at least some specifically political or socially oriented one. So it's like not like they're also going to learn construction and all this stuff, but It's amazing how many things that you can take from one area of knowledge and one skill set and apply to something that seems so out of left field, that they could never have really have anything to do with each other, but you see the same patterns. You see the same relationships, the same principles. And there's unbelievable value in having someone who studies, you know, gets the basic certification in like 100 different skill sets, because that person is going to have so many insights and ideas about knowing how things interact with each other. That's all of how the world is, right? You know, like somebody who is in trucking, somebody who is in shipping and organizing all of that architecture and infrastructure all around the country, and then somebody who is in product management or product design, there might be something critical that one of them knows that could help that person who's designing the product make it so much easier to ship. And it could be something stupid simple, like just changing like one size between like a half an inch or something like that, that easily the product designer could actually do. But then you have this area where they butt heads because they've just created the product in their little bubble where they don't know anything about shipping. They don't know anything about packaging and all of that stuff. And in doing so, their product is like much harder to deal with in some way. And so they're mad at the shipping. They're like, obviously you just do it. You just put it on a truck and take it to where it needs to go. There are so many translation problems in society. And when you're talking about governance and economics and philosophy and all of these overarching things about how we relate to each other as people, that is so much of where those translation problems show up. You know, everybody on the political sphere thinks they're the ones that are actually working and they're the ones with the real problems, and these other guys aren't really doing anything or they're not working hard and they should be the ones to pay. I mean, there's so much ignorance, it's rather profound. Like the idea that you can just tax rich people and give it to poor people and that will solve the problem of poverty is so wrong, so horribly wrong, it pains me. But from the general perspective and the general realm of knowledge, that seems perfectly sensible. Here are people who don't have money, here are people who do have money. Just move it from A to B and you're done. Like, you can't really blame them for thinking that. And without any basis in economics, in how the structure of production and reward and money actually work, yeah, of course. If you don't know how any of that stuff works, seems like a pretty simple problem. And that is basically the perspective that most people take on everything except the one discipline that they know how to do. That specialization provides enormous amounts of productivity and trade within the economy, but if the rules for that trade, for interacting with each other, become a political thing rather than something that's essentially set in stone, and suddenly everyone's specialization is actually now a form of ignorance, it's a form of them being able to easily say, well, it's actually the customer support guys that are causing the problem, not the technicians. And then customer support hates the technicians. You know, like they hate each other because they don't really know the problems and the incredible amount of work and organization that happens in each individual field. When their ability to interact with each other and the mechanisms and rules by which they interact become up for grabs, and there's more, you know, customer support people, and now they're going to make the rules for the technicians, you can so easily just end up with a rule set that makes technicians just not be able to do their job. The ignorance of the people doing the vote, of the democracy, and everybody being specialized only in their discipline, when that affects the rules, then every individual discipline is going to propose rules that only work from their perspective. And so whichever rule set ends up getting put in place, it's going to be ignorant to the fundamental relationships between all of these different institutions and disciplines. This is kind of a huge tangent, honestly, but the idea, going back to the foundation of trying to make this PPE stack, these social phenomena that move and sustain, that grow and sustain because they have this full stack. They have a philosophy. They have an ethics. They have a politics. They have a governance mechanism. And they have an economic foundation. The idea of leaving Bitcoin out of this is really kind of absurd. When you think about it, it's really shockingly ridiculous. And Hass is totally right. There's no way to have one that's even slightly honest about the state of the world without something as powerful and unique as Bitcoin has been being included, being studied deeply, because it affects all of these things. It's so deeply wrapped up into all of this, and that it's even built into all of these elements, separate elements and separate disciplines or ideas, I guess you could say, are built into a single network architecture, both in the sense of like servers and nodes, but also in the sense of the human network that it's made up of. You know, money itself, just in a general sense, money is such a profound social and economic phenomena. And when you're talking about something like Bitcoin that has fundamentally altered the concept of money, that has made a step to pure abstraction of money and the monetary rules, an attempt to narrow down the true nature of what money is in a purely informational sense, that is absolutely groundbreaking. That has never truly happened. The abstraction of money is one of the most fascinating economic things to study, in my opinion. The idea of value in a sort of esoteric form. Like, and I mean that even in the fiat sense. Fiat really is kind of a revolutionary technology in and of itself. The ability to, or the attempt to create a purely informational value, but not being able to secure it without some master. And of course, that master, that centralized power, just becomes horrifically corrupt and abuses the shit out of it. But really, fiat is the first attempt to create something like Bitcoin. It's just a very, very bad one. But there's been plenty of abstract monies throughout history. You know, glass beads, that like, those are truly like rhinestones. Gold, even. You know, despite being one of the most deeply embedded monies in history, I think it actually tends to obscure the nature of money being abstract quite a bit. It's kind of funny that gold bugs seem to universally not understand why gold is good money. They'll point to its characteristics, but they tend to harp almost entirely on its physicality, which its physicality is simply there as a mechanism of proof for the characteristics that it gives it. The fact that it is physical and it has the characteristics of scarcity and durability and portability and all of these things is specifically because it is physical. Its physical nature was the only way to ensure those monetary characteristics. You know, Peter Schiff is such a great example of someone who just completely falls victim to this, that the value of gold as money is because it's physical, because it's a real thing in the real world and I can wear it as jewelry and I can build electronics out of it, which is totally irrelevant. It's totally irrelevant to what makes it a good money. There are plenty of things that I can use as jewelry and I can make electronics out of that are not good money, that are totally crap money. It just so happens that all of the things that have the characteristics that does make it a good money needed to be physical, needed to be something that was real and verifiable in the physical realm. Fiat tried, but because it was not physically verifiable, it was too easy to corrupt. But gold's value is not remotely related to its jewelry or the ability to use it in electronics or that it's malleable or whatever. Those things are what gave it its initial value, its initial ability to use it for A, B, C, or D. So when you use when you apply Mises' regression theorem to gold or any money, what you end up finding out is that for some other reason, it obtained value. And a lot of those reasons for historical monies are the simple fact that it was a collectible. That was a very, very common foundation for bootstrapping a monetary good, just being collectible. Glass beads, wampum, and Nick Szabo talks about, I can't remember what they're called, but in the Kula ring, in the island ring or whatever. Ah, shit, I can't remember the name of the money. But it was just a collectible. It was essentially a jewelry sort of thing that you would pass down like from generation to generation, and you would use, you like, I think they broke them up. I think it worked not unlike the wampum system. But regardless, the idea is that it's simply accrued value for some other reason. And that's why, you know, wheat, salt, cattle, gold, silver, copper, all of these things obtained some sort of value. But then when they started to develop as money, when they started to become valuable enough that people could hold on to them for indirect exchange, suddenly their monetary properties took over. Were they a good money? Were they scarce? Were they divisible? Were they portable? Were they those things that allowed it to achieve a monetary premium, which a monetary premium is explicitly value that it can sustain above and beyond any of its other utility? So if gold can be sustained at $5 an ounce because it's just pretty in general, the only reason it can be sustained at $1,800 an ounce is because it's good money. Because when it begins to develop a monetary premium, a premium above its utility, you can't make enough of it to make it go away. It is purely because its physical characteristics make it so hard to make more of that it can actually sustain a price above what it's actually useful for. If we're specifically taking money out of a concept of utility, which itself is a vast and incredibly important utility, I would personally argue that it's the most important utility in all of the economy, but since everybody just wants to be able to eat it or touch it or wear it, we'll just use that in the context of utility. Money is that thing which accrues value above and beyond its utility, and it's too hard to make more of it to make that value go away. And therefore, it becomes an incredibly useful tool for a medium of exchange, for indirect holding and exchanging of value across space and time. Obviously, there's a lot of other characteristics that go along with that, but scarcity is one of the most important. That is a social phenomena. That is an economic phenomena. And it is profoundly and deeply embedded into what makes society work at all. The idea of not exploring something that has taken that purely into the informational realm, Bitcoin, literally kind of feels like teaching people about data and information, but never explaining or even introducing the concept of the internet. I think it's genuinely that obnoxious. But Hass has a great breakdown. So he gets into the philosophy of this next, which I think the philosophy of Bitcoin is one of the most deeply important elements of the Bitcoin system. And it really is kind of amazing that a piece of software has a philosophy and that there is something deeply tied in its nature, in its implementation, that stakes true meaning behind this philosophy, that is genuinely a totem for showing what these philosophical principles mean. And I think that's largely why the philosophy has remained as pure, I guess you could say, or uncorrupted, so to speak, in the Bitcoin ecosystem, or at least in the hardcore Bitcoin center, I guess you could say. But I just want to hit a handful of the ones in this list before we close this out. So Bitcoin is voluntary, and voluntary approaches are always superior to mandatory ones. Bitcoin is open, and maximum transparency allows for a maximum number of eyes looking at the code and sharing ideas. How does any individual entity possibly compete with this? Now, I want to stop here and talk about transparency. And, you know, just the idea of equality. You know, there's everybody in the world should be able to easily keep a copy of Bitcoin. Everybody, it's open. Everybody should be able to use it. One of these other ones is everyone has the right to send and receive value without a third party. No exceptions. Even for people we dislike, either everybody is free to transact or no one is. The idea that Bitcoin has actually been able to remain true to some of these philosophies, to these imperatives, I guess you say, these principles, at the size that it has become, is genuinely something remarkable. Now, obviously, plenty of people are now in Bitcoin or around Bitcoin who haven't or don't even really embrace much of this or don't even think about it. You know, maybe they don't even know. They're just out on the edge. They just invested and are holding a little bit of coin on Coinbase. They're at arm's length Bitcoiners. But the fact that the core of this philosophy has been sustained and defined through multiple battles and years of challenge and attempts to change it have really been something of a marvel. And I think a critical part of why this is that it isn't subject to so much of the false political interpretation of some of these ideas, of some of these words that are just molded to make whatever somebody politically wants today done sound good, like fairness and equality and transparency. But Bitcoin actually acts as a totem of exactly what we mean by those words. It is so easy to bullshit these sorts of ideas. I mean, how many politicians can we see today promoting equality by specifically categorizing people into groups based on their race, their sex, their income, their vaccination status, and everything else, and then making different rules for each of these groups because somehow we need to subjectively and politically balance any perceived differences between these groups, which the differences are only important based on not where they live or where they went to school or anything like that, but those categorical differences, their race, their sex, their skin color, income, whether or not they're vaccinated. That is not equality. It is literally the exact opposite. It is systemic and purposeful and direct inequality. Real equality is taking every single law or rule or anything that has any of those words or categorizations, whatever, and deleting all of them. There is never a day or a solution to a problem of categorizing and treating people differently that is provided by categorizing and treating people differently in a different way. All that will ever do is breed more racism and sexism and division between these groups. And you force people to think of themselves as their categorization. Never do you fix the problem of judging or thinking of somebody differently by the color of their skin by treating them and judgingly differently by the color of their skin. That is not the solution. It's just flat wrong. It's not going to work. It is going to backfire gloriously. While Bitcoin is true equality, it cannot and will not ever know those characteristics about anyone who uses it. And therefore, it cannot and will never make any judgments or special privileges for any of it. That's the solution. That's the only solution. Having perfectly equal rules for everyone. And there's no ambiguity in this. There's none. This is not up for debate. Bitcoin does not and cannot care. And you will not bring your sexism, your racism, your religious persecution, or whatever special privileges you want to add and put it into Bitcoin. Bitcoin does not play that game. It is about equality for everyone. Equal rules, equal ownership, period. Suck it. That is a revolutionary thing in today's age. Racism is really super popular on both sides of the aisle right now. Then there's transparency. There's openness. You know, I've had I've had debates with normies, and admittedly, this was probably many years ago. I don't really debate on this, or at least I try not to, anymore, because I just think politics is such a comical absurdity. I literally can't see anything. Every time I hear one of the debates, or like hear one of them on screen, all I can see, I can't fathom that someone thinks that there's competency or respect in any of that. It is literally institutionalized bullshit. They don't say anything. I don't know. So not to go down that road, but so I'll argue with, or I have in the past, from people on both sides of the political spectrum who have literally told me that their candidate and their government side of things was just the most transparent ever. Like, they were the most transparent administration ever. I got told this specifically by someone in regards to the Obama administration, and that there was some amazing revolution of transparency that happened when their candidate got in office. And I was just, that view of reality and of the political sphere is so alien to me that I had a hard time carrying on a conversation with this person. But I just couldn't help but wonder, what is your standard compared to what? Where does Guantanamo Bay fit into that? What about the trillions in unauditable and undisclosed funding for damn near everything under the sun? What about the CIA just going, oops, we can't find $2.3 trillion that you could literally outright buy like 10 countries with that amount of money? Where does the fact that the Fed has never been audited ever fall into that? Where does we have to pass the bill to find out what's in it? Where does that fit? Where does the never-ending stock market purchases by congressmen and women, and of course, you know, maybe more like their siblings and wives and husbands, where does that fit? What about the NSA, the CIA, and the plethora of illegal spying programs fall into that? Where does the Patriot Act fall into that? Where does Operation Choke Point fit into transparency and openness? Where do the torture reports fall into that? What is even the most basic shit, like the Freedom of Information requests that get like 90% blacked out just because it's now a national security issue for anybody in government to even look bad? Where does the Snowden leak fall into that? The Bradley Manning leak, the WikiLeaks files, Julian Assange. These people have had their lives thrown into chaos, destroyed, or have been thrown into a dark hole for the rest of their lives, while not one of the horrible illegal crimes, tortures, and murders that they revealed were ever punished. What transparency? I get that everyone is just so excited that their candidate is the freaking hero of ages who's going to come in and fix everything, but Jesus Christ, for somebody, like, get off your knees. Every moron, jackass politician that gets on that podium and feeds us the same horseshit every 4 years like it's something new, and not just another of the 10 billion lies we are told for always and since forever. And then pretend like different personalities are somehow meaningful because one of them's more crass and one of them's a jackass and one of them's a real smooth talker. They are hood ornaments. We get the same absurd spending programs. We get the same wars. We get the same interest rate manipulation. We get the same increase in government into our lives. The same percentage deficit increases that just look an order of magnitude worse every year because they just are. It's so hard to fathom someone can look at that system and even the word transparency, you have to not know what that word means. Where? What the fuck are you talking about? It is literally the most opaque, institutionalized bullshit on the planet. If any one of the administrations we've had in God knows how long is the most transparent, the only possible argument that could be made is that there's like by default a million things hidden and disallowed from public scrutiny because the public is clearly too stupid to know about any of this stuff, and it's dangerous for national security to know that everybody's a fraud and criminal all throughout the entire political apparatus. And they were only planning to add 100,000 new things to that list, but they decided to cut it down to only like 99,981 things. Therefore, transparency. If that's our political foundation for transparency and honesty, I feel legitimately sorry for those people as human beings. Bitcoin is real transparency. It is real honesty. It is the philosophical declaration that never again will the average person not have the right to verify and see with their own eyes and on their own computer the entirety of the monetary history and supply. Never again will they be left in the dark and treated like stupid children at the subject of their masters, who will decide what they should be able to see and what rights and privileges they should be able to have. Not only is that an honorable principle to stand behind, it is an embarrassment that we could fail so badly at providing something so obvious and straightforward to society. Anything short of that is an abomination, and I want zero part of it. And Bitcoin is fair. That's something that I think, I actually tweeted about this the other day. I think that's going to draw a lot of hate from people. People don't like fair. They do not. People want handouts. They want power. They want control. They want to make sure that the person that they don't like or who may have slighted them or looked at them wrong gets punished. They want to make sure that someone who says something they don't agree with can't open their bank account, that they get canceled, that they lose their show or their YouTube or their social media or whatever it is. They want that feeling of justification, of reward from seeing the people they dislike hurt. That is something that politics does a very good job at rewarding. And unfortunately, that is a part of all of us as human beings. And the most evil people are the ones who think they could never be subject to that, that that could not exist in their world, because it is 100% proof that they are acting on it if they genuinely think they are the only humans on the planet that are not subject to that corruption. But in my tweet, I said, fair means it caters to no one. It cannot and will not. Fair means that you are responsible, no matter the result of that, no matter how honest or innocent your mistake. And I'm proof of that. I've lost keys, and Bitcoin doesn't give a shit. And I love that. The fact that my keys are lost are proof of how powerful the ownership of what I have left is. There is no 800 number to call. There is no company to reverse it. There is no presidential decree that can get those back. That is fair, because the consequences, the abuse, and the corruption of allowing that, because it was an honest mistake, because I didn't deserve to lose those bitcoins. The consequences of subjective exceptions is the loss of everything honest and high integrity about the system. The whole thing might as well just not exist. Fair means there are no rewards for what someone deserves or wishes to have, only action and the truth. Fair means it is perfectly unbiased towards gender, religion, country, or whatever stupid political opinion anybody has. Fair means earned, not printed, not issued, not redistributed, earned. And I'll end this with my favorite quote. This is how he Hass wraps this up towards the last paragraph. He says, freedom, transparency, honesty, meritocracy, fairness, voluntarism, and hard work are great things one should strive toward, whether it is in developing money or living life and setting a good example for others. And this is why I think understanding and digging into the origins, the foundations of Bitcoin, they do not teach you just a philosophy of money and economics and potentially politics. They teach you a full stack of how to look at and think about life. It teaches a worldview and codifies it into a network of value whose success proves the benefits and the incredible prosperity of that set of principles. And if that's not a social phenomenon, then I don't know what the hell is. All right, we'll close that there. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you to Hasmik Cook for this piece and Bitcoin Magazine, as always. Bitcoin Magazine is hosting Bitcoin 2022. Do not forget to get your tickets. Go to guyswan.com. Everything's right there at the top of the page if you want to check that out. And I'm going to be adding them to bitcoinaudible.com as well, so either of the sites will have them available. Huge thank you to Fold, to Swan Bitcoin, and to the Bitbox. Just, it's so great having literally my favorite companies and products supporting the show. Really kind of unbelievable that that's what I've got. And they're keeping this thing alive, and that's just too awesome. Thank you guys so much. And of course, the Audionauts and everybody who listens to this show. I think we've got, you know, with all the anger and the heatedness in today's episode, and I can get with guys' takes. I'm so optimistic. I really am. I'm so hopeful for the future. I think this thing is powerful, and I think we have something to hold on to latch on to, and to ride, to instill these principles and to teach them. And build an alternative to the bullshit that we've had to be fostered in, and a way to exit. And I think that's what Bitcoin is. I think the future is incredibly bright. There is a mess of problems to sort through and so many challenges in front of us, but I think we've got the tool, and we've got the tools and the philosophy and the foundation to tackle these things as engineering problems and to see the cypherpunk vision become a reality. That is why I am here, and I hope you guys join me. Exciting stuff to come, so much work happening. I am getting right back to recording. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you to the Audionauts. I am Guy Swan. This is Bitcoin Audible. And until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. This has been Bitcoin Audible, a 111 production.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.